Well, hi, and welcome to updating your database management skills to SQL Server 2014. I'm Pete Harris, and I'm here with Graham Malcolm.
Hi.
We're back again to have another Microsoft Virtual Academy course for you. I've been a database and application platform learning planner for quite a number of years now. Graham and I have worked together for quite a while. And I've been in content in various roles at Microsoft since 1995, helping people learn various technologies that we have here. And today, I'd like to introduce Graham Malcolm from Content Master.
Hi, nice to meet you all virtually. Yeah, as Pete says, we've worked for longer than we care to think about for together on various different things. I'm specifically involved in writing content about SQL Server. I've been a SQL Server consultant and trainer and author for a number of years, going back right the way to version 4.2. So I've been working with Pete recently on some of the new training that we're putting together for SQL Server 2014. And what we want to do over the course of this MVA is introduce you to some of the features, if you're an existing SQL Server 2008 specialist, some of the new features that there are in 2014 that you can look at.
So the Microsoft Virtual Academy community, you're familiar with it because that's where you're watching this. We've got well over 1 million registered users. We have all kinds of training sessions available for you. Graham and I have recorded another one about big data.
Big data. You can see where the big data is.
Hear about HD Insight and learn about where the big data goes. And there's all sorts of things there for SQL Server customers and people interested in data technologies at Microsoft and a whole bunch of other topics. So check that out.
So what we're going to cover in this this MVA, however, is we've got six modules. And as I said, this is primarily geared towards people who are perhaps experienced with SQL Server 2008 and are looking perhaps to move to SQL Server 2014 and want to know what they've missed in the intervening years. So we'll cover a lot of the new technologies that are specifically brand new in SQL Server 2014, but we'll also fill in some of the gaps with technologies that were introduced in SQL Server 2012 that you may have missed if you've been working with SQL Server 2008. So there's a veritable smorgasbord of new stuff for us to look at over these six modules. We'll start off by looking at some of the in-memory technologies, and then we'll work our way through various other features of the product that you might find useful as a database professional. Just to set some expectations, I am anticipating that you are familiar with SQL Server 2008, that you've used SQL Server Management Studio, you're familiar with Transact SQL syntax, you've done the typical kind of database management and DBA type things. So this isn't an intro to databases, it's really just to cover the delta with what's changed since 2008. If you haven't got any background in SQL Server, if you haven't done anything with that, there's lots of MVA material that you could have a look at, so please browse around the rest of the catalog. There's some really good content out there that will help you get up and running and then perhaps come back to this and fill in the gaps then. So, Pete, you and I worked together way back in 2008.
We did.
On that curriculum, and I remember at the time writing the What's New in SQL Server 2008 course.
Feels like ages ago.
It does. It was, actually. It was a very long time ago. We've both significantly changed the color of our hair since then. Mm. And what we're now looking at is 2014. So here we are. The time rolls on, and we're on a new version of SQL Server. So on the slide, what I've tried to do is put together a sort of a timeline, a roadmap, if you like, from what happened in 2008 right up to the present day with SQL Server 2014. And what I've got at the top there are the various features that were introduced in SQL Server, the capabilities that were added to the product with each version that came along. So in SQL Server 2008 itself, we saw the introduction of compression, we saw change data capture come in there. Resource governor, a way of managing the utilization of server resources across workloads, came in there. Policy-based management, things that we kind of take for granted now that arrived in 2008. In 2010, Microsoft released SQL Server 2008 R2, which was an incremental updated version from 2008. And there were a whole bunch of things added in there, multi-server administration using UCPs, these control points to manage different servers, and the data collector were introduced then. Data tier applications, ways of packaging up databases with their server components together and using them to move databases from one place to another, including their server dependencies like logins and so on. That was introduced. Power Pivot, We've just done a session on big data and analyzing big data with Excel, where we use Power Pivot. So that's really come along leaps and bounds and become a really major part of the platform for data. Report Builder 2, Master Data Services was introduced in SQL Server 2008 R2, and we'll be looking at that later on in this MVA. Things like prepared instances, so SysPrep for SQL Server, and Stream Insight, a technology for capturing streaming data that's a constant stream of data points that we want to analyze and capture. So a whole bunch of stuff appeared in 2008 R2. And then not long ago, we released SQL Server 2012. And there were some really significant enhancements in SQL Server 2012, some great changes to high availability, always on availability groups, is one of the things that we'll look at later on in this MVA. Column store indexes, contained databases, oh, there are a whole bunch of things that we're going to look at as we go through the rest of this MVA. So significant changes all the way up through those versions. And now we're at 2014. And again, there are some new significant enhancements that we'll be calling out, particularly in the in-memory space with SQL Server 2014. So we'll be looking at that. And in fact, the first module after this introduction, we'll be looking at the in-memory technologies that have been introduced in SQL Server 2014. But that's only part of the story. SQL Server is not the only game in town. There's a whole bunch of other technologies, as you know well. So if we look at SQL Server in isolation, we can see these changes, but at the bottom, you can see some of the changes that have happened with the operating system, with what's been going in the cloud, with Windows Azure, and what's been happening with Microsoft Office. And these are all technologies that are intertwined with SQL Server. They're intertwined with the data world. So we rely on the operating system, obviously, to host the database server, but also for the management of the overall enterprise. And we've seen significant enhancements in Windows Server and System Center. And more significantly, we've seen that move towards cloud-based virtualized infrastructures. So we have Hyper-V playing an increasingly important role in organizations, and we've seen private cloud and public cloud and hybrid cloud type environments building on those pieces of the operating system and supporting technologies. So that's a significant part of the story as well. And then within Windows Azure, when we look at the public cloud offering, there's more and more up there in the way of ways to manage data. So we introduced SQL Azure way back in 2010, and that's been renamed to Windows Azure SQL Database. So it's a platform as a service solution for databases, but also now we can support virtual machines in Windows Azure that run SQL Server. So we can literally run SQL Server in the cloud in a virtual machine. So some really interesting changes there in the ways that people are using SQL Server to support enterprise and cloud-based workloads. And in Office has come along leaps and bounds, and we've just recently seen the introduction of Power BI as a service for Office 365, where users can use self-service analysis techniques to get data from different sources, combine it, mash it up, and create data models and visualizations from that data. So there's really been a huge kind of change in the way that we interact with data using these technologies. So all exciting stuff, and hopefully that puts everything in context.
It's always remarkable to me how many things end up on a slide like this.
Yeah.
It's a huge list of features and capabilities that have been added over time.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's such a great story for the data platform. Yeah.
I love that we're finding that things are getting more and more intertwined. It's less of the silos of individual products and much more that everything kind of works together to solve the problems that the business might have. So let's roll straight on to module one. And let's have a look at making the most out of memory. And what I want to cover in module one is the changes that have appeared in SQL Server 2014. So most of the things we'll talk about here are brand new in 2014. There are a couple of things that were introduced in 2012, but we'll focus primarily on 2014. And we'll look initially at something called the buffer pool extension, and then we'll talk about column store indexes, and then finally the big new headline feature, if you like, in SQL Server 2014, memory optimized tables. So we'll get a chance to have a look and see how those work. Sound good?
Sounds great.
Okay. So the buffer pool extension, diving straight in at the deep end. One of the things that you'll find if you've been working in the database world for a while is traditionally what happens is the price of hardware just goes down and down all the time. So we find that more and more hardware becomes a commodity, an affordable commodity. And that's true of memory. When I first started in this industry, I'm embarrassed to say, but at that point, buying just, you know, 1 megabyte of memory for your computer was a hugely expensive proposition. And now we've got servers out there with hundreds of megabytes of memory and getting into ridiculous volumes of memory. So memory's become a bit of a commodity. It's going down in price, and actually that's led to a lot of data activity moving to be in memory because we reduced that I/O that we require to read things from the disk. So SQL Server has always actually been pretty good at making efficient use of memory, of caching data that's stored in memory, so it's not stored on disk, so we can very quickly access it. And we reduce the number of IOPS, we call them, the IOs per second. So, we increase the number of IOPS per second, I guess, is the right way of saying that. We reduce the amount of IO that's going on. So what's great about that is we get high performance in our database, which everybody wants, right? However, one of the things we're also finding in terms of technology is that the speed of storage devices has come along, and actually some of that technology has changed. So we're finding solid state storage now offers pretty high speed access without all the moving parts of a mechanical disk. And they tend to be cheaper than memory. Having that type of storage tends to be cheaper than actually buying SIMs of RAM to put in the server. So one of the things that we've seen introduced in SQL Server 2014 is this notion of a buffer pool extension. And the idea is to take advantage of that fast solid state storage and use it kind of like an extension to your memory. So we can increase the size of the memory buffer that we use to cache data in and actually spool some of that out onto a solid state disk. So if you've got a database workload that has a read-heavy OLTP workload, so there's a lot of reading going on, you're reading a lot of data out of there, and a lot of that data is going to be cached, then actually this can be a pretty cost-effective way of improving performance without adding a lot of RAM to your system. You could get a solid-state disk device, you can add that to your system, and then we can extend the buffer out onto that solid-state disk. It's fairly simple to configure. There's no changes to existing applications. They don't need to be aware of what's happening with this. SQL Server just handles all that internally. It only uses the external store for clean pages of data, so your transactional consistency is unaffected by this. But what we do see is an improvement in performance when you've got those high read workloads. So let's actually have a look and see how that's set up. We're going to dive in and we're going to see demos of lots of different things. Let's first of all look at the buffer pool extension and just see how easy it is to set up. So here I am on my SQL Server desktop. And if I have a look at my system here, this is obviously just a demo machine, but you can see I've got a solid state disk attached to the device, attached to the server, and there's nothing in that. There's nothing in that disk at the moment. So let's minimize that down. And here I am in SQL Server Management Studio. And you can see that what I'm doing is I'm making a change to the server, and I'm setting the buffer pool extension on. So I'm turning it on, and when I do that, I'm telling it, here's where I want you to store that buffer pool extension. I'm pointing it to that solid state disk that I've got, and here's the size that I want you to reserve on that disk for my buffer pool. So if I go ahead and run that, the command completes successfully, which is good news. And if I go and actually have a look at the disk now, I can see that it's gone ahead and created that BPE file, the buffer pool extension file, and it's 10 gig. It's reserved that space on my solid state disk, and SQL Server will now use that for caching pages that I'm reading. And if I want to have a look at the configuration and see how the system is currently set up, I've got this sys.dmos buffer pool extension configuration dynamic management view. So slightly long-winded name, but it's the dynamic management view that shows me the information about my current buffer pool extension configuration settings. So if I have a look at that, I can actually see the path, in this case it's the file ID, which is 0, and whether or not it's enabled. In this case, the state is it's enabled. So I've got that information. I can always check and see what sort of configuration I've got. Let's assume I've been using the system for a while and I want to see, well, what's actually cached in there, what's going on. Well, we have this, again, a dynamic management view, DMOS buffer descriptors. So if I have a look at that, and what I get is a description of all of the buffers for the cache. So this is just part of the overall cache, part of which is in RAM. But you'll notice at the very end of this dynamic management view, there's a new column, which is in bpool extension. So I can always check to see if I need to troubleshoot something specifically and see if there are specific pages from objects from tables that I'm querying that are stored in that disk. Then I can go ahead and I can see where that is stored. And let's suppose I need to perhaps resize it or change it, or perhaps I just want to get rid of that buffer altogether. Then I can go ahead and just alter the configuration and turn it off. And if I go and check my configuration again now, I can see that it's disabled. So the point of the story is it's very, very simple. I mean, there's nothing there, Pete, would you say, that's particularly complicated?
Perhaps finding yourself an SSD and getting it put in the box.
Exactly, yeah. So
that's about it.
It's fairly straightforward stuff. And there's no interruption to servers. I don't have to take the server offline or anything like that to do this. You just turn it on, it starts using the device, and then when you're ready to get rid of it, you just turn it off again, and away you go. So let's return to our demo machine. If I can find the... There we go. Sorry, return to our slide machine. And look at something else. So this module is really about different ways of working with memory. And the first thing we've seen, technically, is about working with solid-state storage in order to supplement our memory. This is much more about an in-memory technology, and this isn't necessarily brand new. Column store indexes were introduced in SQL Server 2012. The idea being that you're probably familiar with traditional indexes, where we have rows of data and we have some sort of index key that points to where that row is stored on the disk. What we're looking at here are taking those indexes and flipping them around so that we're actually indexing on columns, because that enables greater compression. Usually you find there's a lot of duplicate values in a column, so the same date will appear hundreds of times, or the same product name, or whatever it might be. So we're able to compress data more efficiently by storing it in terms of its columns, and by compressing it, we're able to store it in memory. And by storing it in memory, obviously, we reduce that number of the I/O operations that are required to get to the data, and generally make things more efficient and faster. So there were some phenomenal gains seen when this was introduced in SQL Server 2012. There were some phenomenal performance gains. I mean, factors of 10, factors of 20, even in some particular workloads, factors of 100 times performance improvement by doing this. Great, great stuff. Works particularly well in data warehouse scenarios where you have a large fact table connected to lots of dimension tables. It's a really effective way of storing that kind of data. So what's new in 2014 is this idea of a clustered column store index. In 2012, they were all non-clustered. And there was one significant issue that we had to deal with that. They dramatically improved performance, fantastic. And they could be combined with other indexes, so you could have a regular, you know, primary key clustered index type thing on there. But they were read-only, and that meant the table was read-only. So great in a data warehouse where you're not really updating the table very often. And there were various techniques you could use to load the data in. Well, there are various techniques you can use to load the data in. So you could partition the table and switch partitions in and out without necessarily dropping the index. Or you could store data in a delta table and then periodically merge that in by dropping the index and recreating it. So there were all sorts of techniques for managing it. But fundamentally, it made the table read-only, which added a little bit of complexity to your workload. In 2014, we've introduced clustered indexes, so clustered column store indexes. They're only available in the Enterprise edition, so that's SQL Server Enterprise. Developer and Evaluation are also variants of the Enterprise edition. The index has to include all of the columns in the table. Effectively, what you're doing is saying this table is a clustered column store index, right? In the same way that a clustered index effectively defines a regular table. It must be the only index on the table, so we can't add any other indexes. It's what's going to be used for your read and write. So you have to be pretty sure that your I/O types of queries are suitable for that type of index. It's going to actually provide you with the benefit. And again, those typical data warehouse and fact table type queries, it works really well for those. It's optimized to compress the data and provide performance, and it's updatable is the key thing. So the table becomes updatable. And actually what happens under the covers is it stores a delta table as well as the main master table. So in memory, there's a column store index, but it stores on disk a small delta table and periodically automatically merges that data in. So to update a column store index, here's how that works. We've got that delta store. And when a new row is inserted, it goes into that delta store until we reach something called the minimum row group size, which is a configurable number of rows. And at that point, those rows are merged into the in-memory column store. So we have this two-part storage. Most of the table is in memory and it's organized in columns and that's how they're indexed, but we have a delta store on disk for new rows. If you delete a row that's currently in the delta store, it's physically deleted, it's gone. If you delete it from the actual column store, if it's a row that's already been merged into the column store index, it's marked as deleted, but the space is actually reclaimed when the index is rebuilt. So you'll see some fragmentation there. And it's fragmentation in memory, not on disk. If you update a row in the delta store, then it just modifies the row in the delta store, same as it would for an ordinary on-disk table. But if you update column store data, then what happens is a delete followed by an insert. So it will delete the row that's in the column store and insert a new version of that row into the delta store, which will eventually be merged into the column store. You don't have to worry about any of this. This is all handled for you under the covers. But that's how it works. That's how the updating a column store table works. So it's a pretty neat solution. If you have a non-clustered column store index and you want to update that, then you've got a couple of options. You can drop and recreate the column store index. So you just simply drop the index, do your update, recreate the index. Works okay with a small table. With a large table, the indexes can take quite a while to be created. And obviously, if the optimal scenario for these is a large fact table, then that's probably a bit of a non-starter. So another way that you can do this is you could partition the table and then switch in your new rows. So if you're always incrementally adding new rows that are going to be for the next partition, perhaps it's partitioned on month, and each month you load a new month's load of data into your data warehouse, then what you can do is create a loading table, a staging table that matches the structure of the partitioned column store table, have the same column store index on that, after you've loaded the data into that, and that won't take long to build because there's a small amount, there's only 1 month's worth of data, and then switch that data into the partition in the partition table. So that's a pretty effective way, and a lot of people in data warehouses, that's how they do bulk loads periodically. If you need to update more regularly than that, so perhaps you've got updates every day and you don't want to be constantly switching partitions, then you could use this trickle updating technique, which is effectively the same as what the clustered column store does, but you have to manually implement it. So you create your own delta table, you maintain your new rows in there, and you might create something like a view using a union or a common table expression so that when I query it, I get the data that's in the column store table and the delta table coming back. So some complexity if you go with a non-clustered column store, but that's a good approach if you need other indexes as well. And if you use a column store, then the whole thing's updatable and it's looked after for you. Shall we have a look?
I have a funny feeling that you're going to show us how quick this actually can be.
Well, let's have a look at column store indexes and see what we can do with these. So I'm going to switch over to the demo machine again. And I'll just close that window because we don't need him. And I'm going to first of all open this data warehouse query. So the idea here is we've got our data warehouse. I'm using the sample AdventureWorks data warehouse. And here's a fairly typical query that we would run. So I'm joining from various different tables. I've got a fact table that has a large amount of data on it. And then I've got various dimension tables that I'm bringing back information. And I'm looking for, across time and product, the average unit cost and the sum of the units out, the number of units that have gone in and out of inventory. So that's a fairly typical data warehouse query. I'm going to run it once just so that it's a fair comparison so that we get the data into cache. Because what I really want to look at, when we look at how long a query takes to run, really the factor that affects that is the I/O. How many reads am I doing? So if I bring it into memory, I can then look at the number of logical reads. How many times am I reading the table in order to get the data? And what we should see is a dramatic decrease in the number of reads when I use the column store index. Sorry if that gives the game away for you. So we'll run that query, and then what I'm going to do is I'm going to set the I/O stats on so that we can see what's actually happening and run it again. And at this point, the data will be cached, and we should actually get a pretty accurate reflection of the number of I/O operations to get the data in. So let's run that query. And it'll bring back two sets of results. First of all, it goes and gets it from the disk, and then a second time, it's going to get it from cache. So if I scroll down, we should see a second set of results down here somewhere. Yeah, Well, there are. Take it from me. The screen's a bit big to see it. There you go. And if I switch to the Messages tab, I begin to see some of the statistics about what's been happening. So I'm just going to increase this area here so we can see what's going on. And what we're getting is the important thing here is the number of logical reads. So there's that big fact table. That's the one that has most of the data in it. And there were 6,396 logical reads to access the data required for that query. So we have a fair amount of I/O to go and get that data. Now, in this case, they're all logical because we cached it, first of all, so it's in memory. But if I'd had to go to disk to get that, that would have obviously been quite a significant number of reads. Okay, well, let's see what difference we can make by adding a column stored index. So I'll go and have a look at this script here. I'll start off with a non-clustered column store index, and I'm going to put that on my fact product inventory table that we've just queried here. So let's go and create that. And it'll take a little while to create because obviously it's going to take that data, restructure it into columns and index it in memory, but that's it done. Didn't take too long, really. And if I go back and we'll just simply run this entire query again and have a look and see what the difference in the I/O is. So Pete, your job is to remember it was 6,396 logical reads, okay?
Got it.
Well, let's run it and see what the difference is. And let's have a look.
Wow.
So we're down to actually, that was a dim product. We're actually down to 5,027 logical reads. So we've dropped the number of logical reads by a reasonable
1,300
amount.
1,300 anyway.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go and have a look and see how we can work with our non-clustered column store index. And what I'll do is I'll try and insert a new row into there. And of course, what I get is an error message because a non-clustered column store index is non-updatable, so we can't put that in there. So let's drop that index and drop the constraint. I'm actually going to drop all of the indexes on that table, and I'm going to replace them with a clustered column store index. So this is brand new in SQL Server 2014. There's our column store index created. We'll just verify that we're still getting some decent performance from that. So let's go ahead and run our query once again. And we're still, you know, much less in the way of logical reads. We've reduced the number of logical reads that are going on there. And if I go back to my column store index table here, I can now insert a row. So I've got an updatable table with a column store index. And if I'm interested in knowing what's going on under the covers, I've got this idea of sys column store row groups. This is a new system view that I can use. And if I have a look at that, I'm combining it with some data from sysobjects just to make the query a bit more meaningful. But if I run that, I can actually see for that table, product inventory, I've got one row in something that's described as open. So that's my delta store. That's the on-disk component of the table. And then in the compressed in-memory part of that index, I've got this number of rows, 776,286 rows. So you're able to actually manage, you're able to see what's happening under the covers with the index as well. So pretty neat.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah. Let's go back to here. And now we get to the headline act. We've seen the support act, if you like. This is the big new thing in SQL Server 2014. And it, I guess, was the kind of primary sort of driving force behind the release. And what we're talking about are memory optimized tables. So what we've seen is the ability to take advantage of memory, the fact that the memory is cheaper and that putting things in memory is a more effective proposition now. And what we've actually got in SQL Server 2014 is the ability to store entire tables in memory and actually compile them as C structs. They're compiled into DLLs, loaded into memory, and they're treated as in-memory objects. So that's pretty neat for a start. We're able to go ahead and create these tables that are compiled as DLLs and loaded. They're persisted as file streams, so they are actually persisted onto the disk if you want to make them durable. So that it's storable data. If you take the system down or bring it back up, it's transactionally consistent. So we've got all of those benefits. But the actual data itself, for I/O purposes, is in memory in this DLL. You do have the option to make it non-durable, And that can be really effective in particular cases, like perhaps you've got a profile table or some sort of state table that you're using in a web server farm where you're storing state in between requests. It doesn't really matter if that's stored anywhere. It's just really temporary data that you use while the session is live. So you could store that as non-durable, and that way there's no overhead of writing to disk. Everything's just done in memory, but it's treated like a regular table. So one or two of the things that make this really fast, obviously it's in memory, which helps. The other is that there's no real locking semantics in the same way that we have with a disk table. We're not locking pages of data on the disk in order to provide the I/O to the locations in memory where the values are stored. And that reduces overhead when you've got a whole bunch of users trying to concurrently access the same data. What typically happens in a database is you end up with a hotspot in the table, perhaps at the end because you've got an incrementing key and everybody's inserting new values. And that last page, if you're using transactions, gets locked. And so you get people timing out as they wait to do inserts. So if you have these kind of what we call latch-bound workloads where there's a lot of locking that's preventing concurrency, then this can be a really good solution for getting around that. So there are indexes that we can use, even though they're in memory, there are indexes. We have the notion of a hash index. And a hash index is effectively a way of saying, I want to index that particular key value. The system will generate a hash from that and then allocate it to a location in memory based on the hashed value. So we get this kind of storage of data based on a hash, and that enables it to very quickly go and retrieve the rows from specific locations in memory. There are also range indexes. We can also use regular non-clustered indexes to find ranges of values. And again, they're just maintained in memory in that kind of specialized B. It's a variant of a B structure. So they can coexist with disk-based tables. So this isn't an all or nothing. It's not that you're creating an in-memory database. What you're doing is creating a database that has some tables that are in memory and some regular disk-based tables. And you can combine the two and work with both quite happily. And you can query these in-memory tables with Transact SQL. To the database engine, they just look like tables. So I can just go ahead and query them. There are some rules, there are some limitations. So we can't include some data types. So you can't include those large binary types like text or image or nvarchar max or any of those larger types of values. But by and large, for a regular table that stores regular sort of, relational values, then you can pretty much create an in-memory version of an on-disk table. So they don't support identity columns. That's the other thing. If you're relying on identity columns, they don't support those. You could use one of the sequence things that was introduced in SQL Server 2012, this idea of just taking a new value from a sequence and using that to insert new values. So there are ways that you can deal with that. And they don't support foreign key constraints. So you would have to have some other mechanism for ensuring integrity across the tables. But by and large, you'll get a lot of performance gains from using these things. So the scenarios for using this, as I said, great when you are having a problem with latch-bound workloads. So you've got an awful lot of users trying to update the same pages of data, and those pages are on disk and they get locked. And of course, what happens then is you end up with hot pages that cause concurrency issues. You do need to, if your application is going to work with this, if you're building applications to work with in-memory tables, your applications will pretty much work unaffected. They'll be able to read and write to these tables just like other SQL tables. But you probably do want to deal with conflict errors, because if you do get an error where you've tried to update a row that somebody else has already updated because there was no locking, you'll have to be able to deal with that. So your application will need that type of semantic to deal with serialization and repeatable read type issues. So to create them, there's a couple of steps. We do need to make a change to the database. And the only change to the database we need to make is we need to add a file group that's specifically for memory optimized data. And that's where, when we persist the memory optimized tables to disk, that's where they'll be persisted. So we create this file group. Under the covers, it uses the same technology as file stream. So you'll actually see when we create this, it's a file stream data group or file group. Then when we go ahead and we create the data file, we just simply add a file and point it to that location. And that then becomes the file that's used for our storing our in-memory data when it's persisted. To create the in-memory table itself, there's the create table. And the only changes that you really need to sort of note here are, one is that the index is a hash index, and hashes consist of buckets. The buckets are effectively just the locations in memory. So we hash a value and store the row in the bucket that relates to that hash value. And then we have, at the end of the syntax, memory optimized is on, and durability, which by default is the schema and the data, so we maintain a copy of the schema and the data on disk. But you could also just have schema only, in which case the data is completely in memory and it's never persisted to the disk. I mentioned hash indexes and how those work. Effectively, what happens is when you index a column, the database engine will generate a hash value for that key value, and that will determine where in memory we're going to store that row. Now, of course, what if two rows end up being hashed to the same value? Well, they both go to the same location in memory, and what happens there is you get a linked list within that memory location to those rows. So it's still very quick, very effective to go and find those rows. It's great if you're using a query that has an equality predicate, so you're checking for where something equals something. Then it's a great way of doing that because you get an exact hash value. You just go to that location in memory, and that's where that data is. The one thing about that you do need to be aware of, and generally good practice in Transact SQL anyway, is that you should be aware of this. There's no guarantee those results will be sorted because, of course, they're hashed, so they'll come back in the hash value rather than in the order of the key, if you like. So if you want them, you need to use an order by clause if you need them sorted. If you choose, you can create range indexes, and it's an in-memory B-tree structure that's created for those guys. You can see the syntax for doing that down in a second example here. It's just index, and then it's an unclustered index. And that's effective when I do range scans. So if you are querying the table and you're looking for, I don't know, all the orders between 1st of January and 6th of June or something like that, then those indexes tend to be more effective for getting the values back from memory. So a couple of options for indexes with memory optimized tables. When you're using them, you might be beginning to think, oh, this is sounding quite scary. These things are compiled as DLLs, they're C structs, so how on earth do I query them? Well, you query them just like any other table. You can actually just use Transact SQL. And what happens is the query engine within SQL Server uses a technique called query interop to go and, on the fly, convert that to the appropriate language that it needs to use to go and query that DLL and get the data back. And it's a pretty high-performance approach that happens there, so that the compilation itself, the compilation of the query, is relatively quick, and you still get much faster results back from the table. So I could just issue a regular Transact SQL statement, and that will work against an in-memory table. However, you can optimize things even further by creating native compiled stored procedures. So if you create a stored procedure regularly with Transact SQL, then obviously that consists of Transact SQL statements that are compiled and run. But if you use this native compilation technique, it's translated to C, compiled to a DLL, and loaded into memory. So you get in-memory optimized C for the stored procedure as well as for the table. And that produces very, very fast query times. You can see you'll see in the demo that really significantly enhances the speed of the query. The only thing to say about native compilation, you can't use that technique to query regular on-disk tables. It only works within memory tables. So that's the only consideration for that. To create a native stored procedure, there's the regular create procedure statement, which I'm sure you're familiar with. But there's a few things to watch out for. There's this native compilation clause. So that's what tells the system this needs to be compiled into a, first of all, converted to C and then compiled into a DLL. There's the schema binding, which isn't a new clause, but it's required when we do a native stored procedure. So in other words, we're binding this to its dependencies so that it won't allow us to drop the tables that this thing refers to. And who it's going to execute as. So you're going to execute as, I guess, in this case, the owner of the stored procedure. When you use a transaction within one of these, and bear in mind the whole point of memory-optimized tables is they behave better within transactions because they reduce locking, the syntax is slightly different from the normal begin tran statement that you would use. It's begin atomic, and you have to specify the isolation level and the language. Other than those changes, everything else is exactly the same as creating a regular stored procedure in Transact SQL. And when you run the create procedure statement, it goes and creates it, generates the required C, and then compiles that into a DLL.
I thought I was going to have to learn how to write C.
Yeah, well, you won't learn that from me. Let's put it that way. Let's see all this. I've talked a lot about it, and we've shown you some of the syntax. Let's actually see in action, and I think you'll really see the benefit of it there. So I'm going to go and get my query. I'll just close all these other query files that I don't need anymore, and I'll go and get my query file for this demo. And the first thing I'm going to do before I go ahead and run the query, I can see I get a little prompt there to remind me. I don't have a database called memdemo, so I better go and create it. And what I'll do is I'll just go and create a new database. And we'll call it memdemo. And the first thing I need to do is I need to create a file group for that memory optimized data. So if I have a look at file groups, you'll see down here in the dialog, there's a space for memory optimized data file groups. So I'll go ahead and add one of those. Call it memfg. And what I can then do is go back to my general tab and add a new database file, which I'll call memdata. And it's going to store, you can't really see it in this dialog, I'll just widen it out. It says it's file stream data. It isn't actually file stream in the sense of storing, you know, unstructured files like we might use file stream for. Because it's using that memfg, which is the only file stream data group I've got, it selects that automatically. And because I've done that, it knows that that's memory optimized data. So it knows that's where it's going to store its memory optimized tables and stored procedures. So, okay, great. We've got that set up. Now, I could just go ahead and click OK and run that, but you know, I'm a SQL guy, I want to actually see the syntax for this. So I'll script that to a new window. And you'll see that most of this is a regular create database table. We can ignore the containment equals none for the moment. We'll talk about that later on in the MVA. But the only main difference to a regular sort of create table statement is this log on. And we've got the file name this one here, the file group name equals memdata. File name equals whatever. And the first one before that is memdemo. That's where our... I'm getting mixed up. It's this one here. File group is that. I'm reading it the wrong way around. So the file group is called memmg, and it contains memory optimized data. And that's my memdata file group that I specified and the file name that points to it. So that's the key difference. This clause here, file group mem whatever, contains memory optimized data. Everything else is just a regular create database statement. So if I go ahead and run that, it goes off and creates the database for me. That's fantastic. And now I'm ready to go ahead and start using my in-memory database. So, or rather my memory optimized database. I'm going to create a table here called memory table. And it is an in-memory table. It's got the memory optimized clause. And I've got a clustered hash index with a fairly large bucket count to store a large number of rows. And I'm going to store schema and data in that. So let's go ahead and run that. And that'll take just a little while to go and allocate the C, but it didn't take too long, 2 seconds. And I've got my table. And what I'm going to do, just for the purposes of comparison, I'm going to create a disk table that has exactly the same schema. So an integer ID column and a date value column. And this one has a clustered primary key. So I've now got two tables that are pretty much identically schema, but I've got one of them in memory and one of them on disk. And I'm going to insert 500,000 rows into the disk table. So let's go ahead and do that. I'll start that running, and you can see it's running down at the bottom. You see it's executing the query. I'm just going to save myself a bit of time. I'm going to grab the same code and do exactly the same thing in a new query, but into the memory optimized table. So I'll run that. And for the memory optimized table, if I look down at the bottom corner here, I can see how long the query is taking. So it's 10 seconds so far. There we go, 10 seconds to do it. We're still actually running the disk query here. It's up to 31 seconds at this point. So already, just by doing that insert, I'm seeing a pretty massive improvement. 32 seconds for the disk-based table, and for the memory-optimized table, 10 seconds. So pretty significant.
It's pretty significant, yeah.
Yeah. Now, the key thing is that was done in a transaction, right? So we got a transaction going on. So there was a lot of locking, a lot of contention, and that's what's taking the time. It's not actually the inserting of the data per se. It's the locking that's causing the delay. So just prove, I always like to prove there's nothing up my sleeve. So we'll prove that in the memory table, we definitely do have our 500,000 rows. Let me just resize this. Yep. And I'll do the same for the disk table. And again, just prove those tables contain exactly the same number of rows, but it took three times as long to actually insert them into the disk table. All right, well, what about deleting rows from a table? So let's delete them from the disk table. And again, I'll just copy that across to the other query. And I'll delete them from the memory table as well. So it's just a straightforward get rid of all the rows. And that took 1 second to do it from the memory table. And it took 16 seconds to do it from the disk table. So again, a pretty significant difference in the way that we operate with these tables. So already we can see, even just using those techniques, I'm able to get a massive performance improvement using this using these in-memory tables. And you'll notice I did a select count from the memory table. It's just regular transact SQL. So I'm able to query it using transact SQL just like any other table. So for my application to be able to get that performance gain at this point without making any changes to the code is pretty significant. What if I bring a native compiled stored procedure into the picture? So here I have the syntax to create one of these guys. It's called insert data with native compilation. So we're compiling that. There's again the transaction. So it's an begin atomic is the syntax I need to use. But then the actual code is exactly the same code we've just seen. I'm inserting 500,000 rows just to show the comparison. So we'll go ahead and take that and create my in-memory optimized stored procedure. Now it took, it was 10 seconds, I believe, to do the insert into the memory table and 32 to do it into the disk table, yeah? Let's see what happens if I use the store procedure. 0 seconds.
That is very fast.
Yeah, that's pretty fast. And just to prove again, there's nothing up my sleeve, 500,000 rows inserted in 0 seconds, sub-second time.
And I didn't have to learn C programming to do it.
And you didn't have to learn C, and neither did I. So,
which would have taken a lot longer.
Yeah, this would be a much longer presentation if we'd had to do that. So pretty neat stuff. This technology really does significantly make a difference to the performance of your workloads. Now, there are considerations. Obviously, it's only going to work for latch-bound type data workloads, and you are going to have that consideration of if you've got a lot of updates, you might need to add some logic to check for repeatable read violations or concurrency violations. But to be honest, sometimes when you're using these in memory-optimized store procedures, the I/O is so fast that actually the chances of those conflicts become markedly reduced. So generally, you find the overall performance of the application is significantly enhanced using these technologies. I just want to finally show you, if you want to have a look at some of the information about your memory-optimized table, you can look at some of the stats. There's a DBXTP table memory stats. So this is how we look at the statistics for that. And if I have a look at that, I can actually see how much memory is allocated to the table and how much memory is currently being used by it, and the same for indexes and so forth. So if you want to monitor the usage of memory by these tables, then you can do that by using that that system view. Great stuff, huh?
It's pretty cool, yeah.
Yeah. So that's the main high new point in SQL Server 2014, and that takes us to the end of the first module. So really what we've covered here is the optimizations we made that are related to memory. We saw that ability to extend the buffer pool out by using solid state storage. So just commodity solid state hard disks, we can add that to the system, and that enables us to very cheaply and cost effectively extend our buffer out into the extend our cache out onto that disk and make use of that. We also saw column store indexes, which are great for data warehouse workloads where you've got a large fact table and you're going to reduce the amount of I/O by compressing the data and storing it in columns, and that's pretty significant. And then we saw memory-optimized tables and native store procedures, which are brand new in 2014 and offer a really significant way to improve performance when you have a latch-bound workload. So what do you say, Pete? You ready to move on and look at something else?
I think I have to go buy an SSD.
Okay, well, once Pete's been to buy an SSD, we'll be back to look at the next module and we'll see some other new cool stuff in SQL Server. Thanks for joining us.